From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
This is MC Fontaine welcoming you to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. This is the second and final part of Nick Coffer's BBC Three Counties show, which was broadcast from Block B at Bletchley Park during the third Enigma Challenge. It starts with Nick being taken on a tour by Bletchley Park guide and historian Joel Greenberg.
Joel Greenberg is one of the historians here and also hosts some of the tours that you yourself can visit if you want to book yourself on. He showed me around this site earlier on today.
I'm right in the heart of Bletchley Park, literally in the park part, overlooking the very pretty lake. There are birds on the lake, and the house is in front of me, the mansion house. And behind me, in a completely different style, are these very old 1940s style buildings. Joel Greenberg is with me. Joel, what are we looking at behind us here?
We're looking at some of the wartime huts that were thrown up in 1939 after the Government Code and Surface School arrived around August 15th. The mansion house was obviously here. Pre-war rich family house, and as the Government Code and Cypress School came here, MI6 decided to use this place. They had about 55 acres, and they wanted to establish a war station for intelligence activities outside of London, and of course to accommodate the people they were going to come here. Started with about 200, they started throwing up wartime wooden huts. Hopefully they thought they would last 5 years, and they're still here 70 odd years later, some of them.
Hut 3, and it's fair to say, Joel, that it's somewhat dilapidated. What's it made of?
Most of the huts were made from Canadian pine during the war. You see some brickwork here. All huts were surrounded by 6 foot high bomb blast walls. They're obviously worried about being attacked. Most of the windows had shutters hinged at the bottom so they could flip them up quite quickly when it got dark at night. They didn't want light. This was a 24-hour operation, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Can we go in?
No. We can't. They're unsafe. Actually, Hut 3, we do let the odd VIP visitor in because it was used after the war through the 1970s and early 80s. Hut 6 hasn't really been used since the war, so the floor is pretty unsafe. But the good news is that the restoration of Huts 3 and 6 are part of the regeneration project with Heritage Lottery funding that's about to start.
Tell me what went on there. We're looking here at Hut 3. It's kind of it's got a structure of a church in many ways, with a pointed roof, flat walls. It's painted red, although that red is definitely peeling away here, as we say. It does look slightly dilapidated. What would have gone on in here in Hut 3?
Yeah, well, interesting. Hut 3 is deceptively big. It's a bit of a TARDIS because it wraps right around the back, so it's much bigger than it looks. Hut 6 and 3 dealt with the intercepted German Army and Air Force operational communications. Hut 6 decrypted them. Hut 3, they were then passed to Hut 3 for translation from German to English and then analysis. If the information from those decrypted messages proved useful, it was then used as intelligence.
Just looking here at this building, it is clearly not luxurious. The park itself was clearly not luxurious, and yet they were working here for hours and hours on end. It must have been very tough.
It was indeed, because the thing that most people don't realise is the age of them. The vast majority of people here during the war, average age is between 18 and 21. So when you're that age, you do have a lot of energy. They worked 3 8-hour shifts, midnight 8 in the morning, 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon, 4 in the afternoon to midnight, so they kept coming and going, but some people would work right through into the next shift, they wouldn't go home, so there was pretty relentless work, not at all glamorous, very relentless and tedious and repetitious.
You're obviously a tour guide here. Has it ever been mentioned to you that there's quite a spiritual feel to these huts and this whole site? It does feel like you're standing in the middle of something quite powerful.
Absolutely, and while we don't yet let visitors into Block D. Block D became the ultimate code-breaking nerve center of Bletchley Park. It opened in February 1943. A huge building, some 56,000, 57,000 square feet. Second largest building at Bletchley Park. It'll be hopefully part of phase two of the regeneration. When you go inside the atmosphere, you can feel a ghost. It's absolutely fantastic.
Where should we head next?
I suggest we go around the corner and show. I'll show you what the people in these very primitive huts at the beginning of the war eventually ended up in.
We've reached a point where the modern day meets the war effort, really, because in front of me is a housing estate, some new houses around the field. And Joel, you're standing on a concrete plinth, and you seem to be quite proud to do so. Well, what are you doing up there?
This is the steps to Block F. Block F was the largest building at Bletchley Park, close to 70,000 square feet, and it was built to house 4 of the 10 Colossus computers that were at Bletchley Park during the war. Colossus was designed and built to help deal with a second system used by the German High Command, the better known system Enigma, was used by the German Army, Air Force, and Navy for short operational communications. They had another system, if you like, Adolf Hitler's communication channel to his army generals, and Colossus was built to help deal with that traffic.
I think if there's one word to describe Bletchley Park, and this is perhaps what's surprising me the most, is it's a sprawl. It really is a vast sprawl. And we've gone from the very dilapidated wooden huts to a much more, well, I say modern structure, it's probably the wrong word, but certainly a much more brick-like structure here. Joe, what are we in front of?
We're standing in front of Block D, which opened in February 1943. As the numbers grew and Block D opened, the numbers were ramping up, 6,000-7,000 people.
6,000 or 7,000 people, yeah, on this site.
Yeah, well, the Government Code and Service School probably employed closer to 10,000. There were certainly about 8,000 working on this site on a day-to-day basis, but again, a 3 8-hour shift system. The main difference was that we've just been by Hut 6 and 3, which is a very crude, primitive operation. For example, to speed up the transfer of documents between the two buildings, there was a wooden tunnel built, but the transfer mechanism was a tray on wheels being pulled back and forth with bits of string, and in fact, according to a veteran who was here just a few weeks ago, a broom handle was rattled in the tunnel to let them know there were some documents to pull through. We're now standing in front of Block D, which for February 43 had all mod cons. It had what at the time were state-of-the-art pneumatic tubing systems, underground pulley system. In fact, just about where we're standing under the road here, there was a pulley system which went under the road to transfer documents from the building behind us to the building opposite.
We've gone full circle. We're almost back where we started, Joel. And you say this was the third part of the triumvirate of work that you did here at Bletchley.
Yeah, we're standing outside of Block C. Block C held something called the Index, a huge operation involving a pre-computing technology called Whole Earth Punch Cards. And these things, you could put textual data, which could be searched, sorted, and collated. Every scrap of data was stored. They were processing over 2 million of these cards a week. So it was a huge operation. And I'll just give you an example of how the cryptography coupled with the underlying data together yielded results. A message went through the Bletchley Park process. It was decrypted, translated, and it simply said, Lieutenant Kellner to report immediately to Foggio. They think, what possible use can that be? One guy called Kellner being sent to Foggio. But they had a record of this guy in their, in effect, database. They looked him up. They even knew his name, Lieutenant Godfrey Kellner. 6 months previously, he'd been sent to Saint-Omer in the north of France. Mentioned in two other decrypted messages, and it was clear from those that his job was approving airfields for use. He's now been moved to Foggio on the Mediterranean. Therefore, the analysis is the Germans are building airfields in the south of France, and they're moving fighter aircraft from the northern front to the Mediterranean theater. Now, that information from the message alone would not be obtained, but coupled with the underlying data that they stored in this building opposite us, allowed that bigger picture to emerge.
It's brilliant stuff, Joel, and thanks for bringing it to life here, right in the heart of Bletchley Park. Let's head back to where we started.
Do you know what? My aim today is to bring Bletchley Park to life for you, because we all hear about Bletchley Park. We mention it so often here on BBC Three Counties Radio, but I really wanted to experience it for the first time and experience it for you and hopefully inspire you to come along. And Joel Greenberg, wonderful tour guide, full of stories, could quite easily have done an hour documentary with Joel. If you've been listening to the programme for the last 2 hours, you'll have thought, yeah, he's in a really busy place. He's in Bletchley Park. It's really buzzing. You've all gone really quiet. What's going Basically, what happened here is that the Three Bells, who are performing our live entertainment today, they're very much a 40s and 50s style, Andrew Sisters style group, are standing here ready to sing us a little snippet of a song, a short song, and we'll have another one from you before we leave you at 3 o'clock. And as I said to the audience, if you think they're any good, please applaud. But it was also taken as code. Of course, this is the right place to be taken as code, as be quiet. You don't have to be this quiet, but we're going to ask the Three Bells to sing now. They are Gail, Betty and Dorothy. Your real names, are Annika, Sally and Izzy as well, is that right?
Yeah.
I quite like the girl, Betty and Dorothy, though. Now, you've got a minute-long song for us. What's it called?
I'll Be With You in Apple Blossom Time.
Yeah, but what's the song called?
I'll Be With You in Apple Blossom Time.
Off you go. This is the Three Bells in Bletchley Park for you on BBC Three Counties Radio.
I'll be with you in apple blossom time. I'll be with you to change your name to mine. One day in May, I'll come and say, happy the bride that the sun shines on today. What a wonderful wedding there will be. What a wonderful day for you and me. Church bells will chime, in apple blossom time.
I think it's fair to say they really like that. What are you going to sing for us before 3 o'clock?
We're going to sing a song called Give Me Some Skin.
Give Me Some Skin? Yeah. What does that mean?
It's a low five. Or a high five.
It's a Down With The Children phrase, is it?
Oh, yeah. But from the 40s.
Really? Yeah. How fascinating.
The GIs used to say it. Give me some skin.
Do you know, I had no idea. I've learnt a new phrase today and probably a new song as well. More from Three Bells just before 3 o'clock. Of course, without Bletchley Park, it is fair to say, well, perhaps not fair to say that we wouldn't have won the war, but it is certainly fair to say that the war would have been longer had they not broken those codes quicker. And we also owe Bletchley Park a huge debt if you're on your computers now, because, in effect, the first computers were invented at Bletchley Park. And the one that I'm going to be playing with, I've got to stop saying playing with, the one I'm going to be looking at, the bomb machine, really could be from 2013. It was built in the 1940s, and it was in no uncertain terms 70 years ahead of its time, and we're absolutely steeped in history here at Bletchley Park. Lots of people know very little about the place though, which is why they've got great volunteers here to bring it to life. Let's get educated together. Here with me are Jonathan Byrne and Peter Westcombe, two of the volunteers here at Bletchley Park. Good afternoon to both of you.
Hello there. And hello to you.
Straight to the point, what are these stories of naked people sunbathing on the roof of Bletchley Park and skinny dipping in the lake?
Well, I've been trying to get to the bottom of this, but no veteran has yet owned up to it. But I can tell you a story about a lady changing her clothes at a railway station. A lady who was a Wren here working on Colossus tells me that when she used to go off duty down to London, the easiest way to do it was to go to a nearby railway station, change into her glad rags, as she put it, leave her uniform in a cow shed, and by great luck, it was still there when she came back the next day to go into work. And that is a true story.
It's a good story as well. And we haven't really touched on yet, Peter, the role of women, Jonathan, the role of women at Bletchley Park. We've talked about these great men touring and many of the maths geniuses are not really focused on the women. What was the role of women here at Bletchley Park?
Well, about two-thirds of the people who worked here were women. They did all sorts of things, from the cryptanalysts, the cracking the codes. As we've heard already today, they operated the bombs. They a lot of them were linguists, translating the decrypted signals into English so they could then be turned into intelligence reports. Women manned the communication centre, so all the signals coming in and out, the vital information was handled by women. Generally, women were absolutely key to the way this place worked.
Your official title here is Role of Honour Administrator. What does that mean?
My job is to identify and record everybody who worked at Bletchley Park or at related locations on signals intelligence in the Second World War. So we have a list now of over 10,000 names, and we know there's a lot more to capture. I've also been interviewing, and helped greatly by volunteers, interviewing many of the veterans who are here, and that's where we get these amazing stories, both the social side, about the story of changing your clothes to go to London, and also how they did the job, how they operated the bombs, how they decoded the signals. And it's been absolutely fascinating and a privilege to meet these people and record their stories.
I'm going to really put you on the spot now, for which I apologise in advance, but give me an idea of some of these stories. Bring Bletchley to life through the eyes and experiences of these people who worked here and volunteered here.
One of the things we always ask is about the food. And we get two stories. Some say the food was fantastic, given that it was wartime and it was rationing. Others say it was terrible. A lot of people say, I wasn't really bothered about the food, but it was okay. So that's one of the aspects that's always we always ask about. Another one is billeting, where people actually lived. A lot of people, remember, some of the people here were from quite sort of, how shall I say, high-class backgrounds. And they found themselves living with railway workers, with local people, farm people. And they became lifelong friends, and many of them remained in touch till very recently with the people they were billeted with.
And that's entirely understandable, because they were working under such pressure, in such difficult times, in such close proximity to each other.
That's quite right. And the time off, leisure times, are very important. We get some excellent stories about the plays they put on, the music concerts, the chess matches. A lot of the people who worked here were chess champions pre-war. Several of the people who were chess champions. If you think about it, if you've got the mind for chess, it's probably the sort of mind, that the thought patterns you need to break enemy codes.
Peter, you're a volunteer supporter here. Were you involved in originally saving Bletchley Park?
Well, I was the one that actually started the campaign to save Bletchley Park. What happened was, this was May 1991, and I was just about 11 months from being retired. And I knew about Bletchley Park because I was at Hanslope Park when I was back in England. And, of course, Hanslope Park was part of Bletchley Park during the war. So I knew the story, because a lot of the chaps who did the work from there, the SLUs, the SUs, the agents and so forth, operated. They were friends of mine. So when I heard the park, in fact, was about to be demolished for housing estate, I spoke to a local friend of mine called Peter Jarvis, a local GP, because he knew everybody for miles around. I didn't. And we were both members of the local archaeological society, so we decided to go to the council meeting here, where they're going to discuss Bletchley Park. When Bletchley Park was discussed, the council said, oh, no, knock it down, you know, it's all over and finished with. And we walked out, and I said, well, you know, we said, well, that's it, you know, there's nothing we can do. So I went home and sat down and thought, and I thought, and suddenly about 2 weeks later, the penny dropped. And I thought, I had an idea. So I said to my wife, look, this is what I'm going to do. She said, well, you're going to retire in a few months' time, so I don't want you under my feet. Go and do something. So I went down. We both went down.
Reasonable when you think about it.
When you think about it, yeah. So we went down and saw Peter Jarvis and his wife, Sue, and I said, look, this is my idea. Why not throw a party for all the codebreakers we can find in Bletchley Park to say farewell? And he said, that's a good idea. So he said, well, we're members of the Archaeological Society, get them to write the letters on our behalf, because if I say Peter Westcombe invites you, I say, who the devil is Peter Westcombe? So anyway, we got this letter written, and they came in. Well, the lady in Bletchley Park at the time, she was Doreen Sawyer. There's only 9 people in the whole park by then. So I said to Doreen, I went in to see Doreen, and so Doreen said, what are you doing here? So she said, I'm going to come. She said, this is your private property, get out. So she kicked me out. So I went out the gate, walked down the little alleyway towards the station, come back through a hole in the fence, and said, now look, Doreen, so I'm talking about... So Doreen...
You came back through a hole in the fence.
And I said to Doreen, this is what I want about. Oh, okay, she said, well, yes, I'll see if you can get permission to throw a party. So she got hold of BT, and BT said, well, how many? She said, oh, about 20. So she said, fine, you can have a party for 20. Well, when the invites went out, 200 people accepted it. So when the big party was, which we did for all the code breakers we got our hands on, we were, Doreen and I was biting our fingers at the door, at the gate, said, hope BT don't turn up, we'll get thrown out. Anyway, so that's actually where the campaign to save Bletchley Park started.
And we were chatting to Ian Standen, the CEO, about this a little earlier on, the sheer surprise at the weight of support that you got. Yes, I think it is an inspiration to groups across the three counties, be they in small villages, large towns and cities, that if you don't do it, if you don't get off your backside and ask for it, we are going to lose these places of heritage across the three counties.
Well, if you don't do it, nobody else will. And the point was, of course, that so then, of course, we got a group of volunteers, and the thing was, the volunteers stuck with us all the time. We were a sort of band, or a mob, actually, I think we were. And we ran short of money. We didn't have money to do this. We couldn't afford to do that. But we struggled on, and we eventually got to move into the bungalow in there, because originally we had an old charity shop downtown. and we used to sell things from there to get money. Well, we got into the bungalow, then the roof of the bungalow collapsed on us because of the rain, so we moved out there, got into the house, and that's how things went. And it was this sort of hand-to-mouth existence on there. What's going to happen today? Oh, well, you know, it doesn't matter. Let's get on with it.
And I think what's wonderful about the story as well is that the togetherness and the sense of solidarity that you had at Bletchley Park during the war, in effect, has been recreated by the local community and the volunteers. Jonathan and Peter, thank you both very much for bringing it to life for us. And Peter, thank you for being at the forefront of saving this in the first place. We wouldn't be here if...
And all the volunteers that went with me.
We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for those volunteers. I'm going to be having a go on the bomb machine. I'll say it again, it's not bomb, B-O-M-B, it's bomb, B-O-M-B-E. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing, and they're actually going to let me press the buttons. I'm back in front of the Turing bomb. This is the machine at the heart of the decoding operations here at Bletchley Park, just outside Milton Keynes. And they've given me permission to press some buttons. They don't know what they're letting themselves in for, not least because Catherine, who works here, just whispered in my ear, said, only touch what they say because or else you might blow yourself up. This is not looking good. If you weren't listening at the start of the programme, let me describe this beautiful machine to you. The way I described it earlier on was like the most complicated vault door or safe door that you've ever seen. You know how you get the codes on the door of a safe that have sort of letters and numbers? That's right, here we go. They turn around like that. And there are the best part of 100. Paul Keller, how many cogs are there?
I wish you hadn't asked that. Three sets, 36 times three, okay, each of which represents an Enigma wheel, and they all turn in step, looking for a possible position where the wheels in the Enigma that coded the message might have been.
That's 108 in total. And it is a thing of great beauty, bearing in mind that this was built back 70 years ago, and yet it looks really contemporary. These guys were quite literally years ahead of their time, and I really would recommend you come down and look at it, because as much as I can describe it to you, as much as I can try and give you a sense of it, it's only when you're right in front of it, and I've actually come inside the barrier here to be allowed in front of it, that you get a sense of the real drama of it. And if you go behind it, I'm doing my Wizard of Oz moment here, because this is, you may imagine me as the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. This is the back workings of it, and it's just an incredible labyrinth of cogs and wheels and wires, Paul.
Yeah, it is. Mostly what you see is, oddly enough, is the oil system that dripped oil on all the gears. Then over here, you've got a wonderful collection of relays and resistors doing what it does. It's all set up with a wonderful series of cams to time. It was a fabulous piece of engineering, as well as a fabulous piece of code breaking.
I think that sums it up beautifully, actually. You're right. Not only is it great mathematically, but just in the way it's built, it's pretty phenomenal. I tell you what, it's time that I press a button. I've been looking forward to this all day. Now Ian Seddon is here, but they call you odd job, Ian.
Yes, they do, yes.
what am I pressing? Oh, yes, the on button.
Well, there's two on buttons, and there's one around the corner as well.
So which one do I do first?
Well, if you can press that one down, and then that one down.
Here we go. I'm going to turn on this beast of a machine.
Then you go round to Paul.
I can hear it starting to crank up. Paul, if I press that, I won't blow myself up.
Correct.
Okay, here we go. I'll count myself down. 3, 2, 1.
Well done. You got it right.
And it's cranking up in front of my very eyes here. And what's happening, if you imagine, there are three blocks of cogs. Three rows in each block. And the top row of each block is whirling really, really fast, like a wheel. Then the two rows underneath are whirring progressively slower. So the way I'm imagining this, and I'm no mathematician, is it's the top row that's doing all the hard work, the middle row is following suit, and the bottom row is the clever one that seems to get the final result. Paul, is that about right?
Close enough. Yeah, each time the top one goes round, the middle kicks on one, and then when the middle one goes all the way round, the bottom does. So it's looking at all the 26 times 26 times 26 possibilities.
If you've got children or grandchildren, bring them along to see this wonderful machine. They will simply stand enchanted in front of it. I'm going to turn it off. There we go. And in all honesty, I feel really privileged to have had a go with that machine. When you think of the history and you think of the role that it's played in our own history, both locally and internationally. The three bells, Gail, Betty and Dorothy, one more for us. What have you got?
Give me some skin.
Off you go.
You love my smile, you love my smile. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. You love my smile, you like my style. Why don't you make me know it? You like my walk, you like my talk. Well, there's only one way to show it. If you want to shake my hand, like they do in Harlem, stick your right out and shout, give me some skin.
my friend. Step right up and take your stand. You don't have to be timid. Stick your hand right out and shout. Give me some skin, my friend. Smack it, whack it. Let your hair rotate. Show it, blow it. Put it in your pocket for a future day. If you want to shake my hand, like they do it in Harlem. Stick your hand right out and shout. Give me some skin, my friend. If you like my smile, then show it. If you like my style, let me know it. If you like my walk, please tell me. If you like my talk, well, skin me, papa, skin me. If you want to shake my hand, like they do in Harlem, stick your hand out and shout, give me some skin, give me some skin, give me some skin, my friend.
Gail, Betty and Dorothy, give me some skin.
Yes.
Thank you. Up there and down there.
Yeah.
You see, I learned the lyrics of the song. Thank you so much for keeping us entertained today, and you were so perfect for the period we're talking about today. It's been wonderful to have you all.
Thank you for having us.
I must say a huge thank you to all the staff, from the CEO through to his volunteers, all the people that work here as well at Bletchley Park. It's been absolutely fascinating for me. As I said right at the start of the programme, I've heard about Bletchley Park, I've covered it on my programme, I've welcomed Catherine Lynch into my studio to talk about it, but I haven't been here. And as with all great things, and as with all great tourist sites, you need to come to understand it, to enjoy it as well. It is a tourist attraction, it wants visitors, it needs your help as well. It's a not-for-profit organisation. They need to fund all the remarkable work that they're doing here at Bletchley Park. So do seek out more information about them online. Of course, if you just go to your favourite search engine and do a search for Bletchley Park, all routes will lead to Bletchley Park. And if you want to come along to visit, well, it's a couple of miles outside Milton Keynes, right in the heart of the Three Counties Patch. It's goodbye there from Bletchley Park, but I'm not going to say goodbye today. I'm going to leave it in the hands of three girls who can do it much better than I ever could.
Goodbye.
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 From the three bells at Bletchley Park.
So how have you found Bletchley Park today, Nick?
It's everything that I hoped it would be, and it's also surprised me in equal measure. I was very surprised at quite how big it is. I didn't imagine Bletchley Park to be such a sprawl, and it really is a sprawl. And it's such a mix of different styles as well. You've got the home, the mansion house, the old buildings, the wood buildings, and then, of course, just on the perimeters, the new build houses. It surprised me in many, many ways, but it is really what you're trying to achieve here, which is a fantastic tourist destination.
Because the site was actually about four times the size during the war that it is now, and some of where you see it's been built on. But having been sort of immersed in Bletchley Park myself for a few months now, I'm interested to hear what it's like to come in and see it for the first time.
What I love when I come to sites across the three counties, and in fact anywhere, is when you walk in somewhere or drive in somewhere and you get an immediate sense of history. And it doesn't have to be an 1,000-year-old church to get that sense of soul and history. In many ways, if you look at the buildings here, objectively, they're very soulless. They're very practical, they're functional, built in the 1940s. And yet actually, the real atmosphere is completely the opposite. I've been very taken by the incredible sense of history and lives and stories that were central to Bletchley Park. So as a new visitor, it's been a day of surprise and pleasure. And also, I'm just pleased to have finally got my head around the whole code-breaking thing, because we talk about it so much, and yet it is quite complicated.
Oh, absolutely. And therein lies the genius of what they achieved. And there is your radio car reversing. I think you're going to miss your lift if you don't go.
It's appropriate, though, because here we are at a centre of technology and genius and mathematics, and here we are doing a radio programme. In many ways, we wouldn't be here without much of the work you did here.
Thanks for listening. Why not follow our channel on Audioboo, where you can also subscribe to the RSS feed? Or you can subscribe to us in iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter, where we're at BPark Podcast, or join the Bletchley Park Facebook group. So thanks again to the BBC Three Counties OB team, Emma Smith and Gareth Lloyd, Nick Coffer, Joel Greenberg, the Bomb Rebuild team, and the Three Bells. And of course, we must thank Audioboo, who make this podcast possible.